turn this on. Okay, this is working. In terms of the term papers, this is especially relevant for the students here. I sent around a message earlier in the day, which I will do periodically as I come across materials and possible topics. I don't know the extent to which all of you have definitively figured out what topic you would like to do. But in any case, I will send this stuff around. Yeah.
I may be remembering incorrectly, but I think that next week is the week where we have no session.
Right.
And that next week was the week for which we, on the syllabus, you originally scheduled the proposal to be written for the paper. Do we delay that a week, or do you want it by email anyway? Or?
I would say, if you can do it by next Wednesday, that's great. Then I'll just take it with me and think about it at this meeting I'm going to. But the formal date for the proposals then would be the following.
Okay.
The following Wednesday.
They don't know that there's no meeting next week.
Oh, so yes. Next Thursday, a week from today, I have to be out of town, so we're going to skip next week, but then add it on in April. So if you look at the schedule that's posted on the website is correct. It has no session on the 20th, and the last session is on April 17th rather than April 10th. Okay?
Okay.
Any questions, issues? We have a visitor, Rahul Mahajan, who is a grad student in the department, but because of heavy language instruction that he's doing, studying Arabic, he felt he couldn't take on writing a term paper, but nevertheless wants to participate in the seminar discussions.
Hola.
All right. Any other questions, issues, loose ends? We have established a new rule in this seminar, which is no eating from things in plastic bags. It was reported by Rudolfo that this caused great distress. So I want you to observe how everything is now in little paper bowls up.
I'm working on it.
Yeah, dump it out quick. But you can make as much noise at your end as possible, as you want to. Don't worry. Okay.
Can we get bowls made of hemp or something?
All right, let's hit it. Let's get down to business. So today, the chapter is called Thinking About Alternatives to Capitalism. The central structure of the chapter is a review of what I'm characterizing as classical Marxist accounts of this problem, the classical Marxian way of dealing with this problem. I regard it as not a direct and literal exposition of Marx's own views, but of the kind of center of gravity within the classical tradition of Marxism. That's why the discussion isn't filled with quotes and specific references to specific authors. It's certainly not meant to be a comprehensive review of the complexities of these theoretical positions, but it is an attempt, and I believe a faithful one, to capture the central strategic logic of the problem. That is, the problem of how do you think about alternatives, and in the Marxist case, my argument is that the Marxist tradition has tried to do what might be called an indirect strategy for dealing with the problem by showing that capitalism is not possible in the long term, rather than by demonstrating that a socialist alternative is possible. What's shown, or attempt to be shown, is that capitalism is ultimately an impossible social system. Impossible meaning that it destroys its own conditions of possibility. And then the idea is, if you can show that capitalism is impossible and also demonstrate that at least some of the conditions for a socialist alternative are likely to be in place, you've added credibility to the project of struggling for that alternative. In the end, as you know from reading the chapter, I feel that the effort, however brilliant it is in its intellectual structure, is not theoretically satisfactory, and the last part of the chapter then is an attempt at presenting in a very stripped down way at least some of the core criticisms of that theoretical argument. Okay, that's by way of my introduction. I've organized the comments in terms of which of the main theses in the exposition of the chapter the particular criticisms or comments or issues get raised. And I've done a little bit of grouping, not a whole lot, among different people's comments. And I thought what we should do is move down this list of theses, and then at the end there's a few additional themes that people, questions raised that I didn't feel felt simply within one or another of these central theoretical postulates. So the first thesis in the chapter is the non-sustainability of capitalism thesis, which I argue centers on the ways in which the laws of motion of capitalism generate both long-term tendencies and short-term processes, which, when they intersect, make the system more and more fragile over time. The key idea is a systemic process by which capitalism becomes more rather than less vulnerable to challenge. To me, that's the pivot of the argument. The strongest versions would say that that process, if it's allowed to run indefinitely, eventually makes capitalism so fragile that it basically falls apart if you breathe on it. It's just a completely vulnerable structure. And if that's true, and if we're struggling against this increasingly fragile structure, unless our capacity for struggle also declines progressively, then we should be in a better and better rather than worse and worse position to overthrow it. So that's the non-sustainability of capitalism thesis. Okay, let's do the first comments. I think Julian's and Todd's comments are connected. They weren't exactly the same, but I think you were both addressing similar issues about how and the nature of the relevance of crisis for this argument about vulnerability. So maybe, Todd, if you want to go first. I was reacting most to the very end of your comment.
Right. I think that upon consideration, most of that is actually irrelevant. But
and you're the fastest speaker in the crowd here.
Yeah, so
slow down.
I think that one way to think about it is, it seems like, and this just could be an artifact of the presentation of the argument in the chapter, but it's as if the unsustainability or the negation of the non-sustainability thesis becomes a sustainability thesis, in the sense that it could seem as though your argument, and I'm not sure if you are or not, that you're saying, well, in fact, capitalism can proceed indefinitely in the sense that we now know it. And that seems different to me than just saying there's an intrinsic tendency for capitalism to destroy the conditions of its continued existence. And so one way to think about this is to say, well, perhaps crises don't get worse and worse, but they do continue to happen, and so there's a sort of ebb and flow of conditions in which capitalism is not economically reproducing itself, and so there's these sort of structural possibilities for change. And the other thing I think is really important is actually Molly's question here about the time frame issue, because, you know, again, thinking about is it that capitalism is sustainable indefinitely? Well, we don't, you know, what'll happen in conditions of negative population growth, which presumably has to happen at some point, right? Or at least non-population growth. So,
Julian, do you want to add something to this opening? Sure, and one of our many interpreters will. Julia McReynolds will be your interpreter today.
She wants to ask whether Spanish and English are not absolute.
No, mi pregunta venía más allá de tu, compartiendo tu tesis de que
my question,
en principio
on the
no
one
hay,
hand, I agree with your thesis that there isn't
una no sustentabilidad en largo plazo del capitalismo,
that capitalism
una progresiva crisis,
sustain
¿no?
itself in the long term.
O sea, aún así, aunque no hubiera un crecimiento progresivo de crisis,
but even so, if there's not a growing tendency toward crisis,
del siglo pasado, ¿no? Y de este siglo muestran que es imposible pensar los procesos de cambio social en sentido positivo o negativo.
But looking at the last century and this century, we see that it's impossible to think about social change in a positive
independiente,
sense.
Independientemente de los procesos de crisis, ¿no?
Independent
y en ese sentido, la pregunta es un
process.
Poco. En tu propuesta de construir una teoría estructural de las posibilidades, ¿no?
So, a ver, espera. ¿Otra vez esa última parte? Disculpa.
Sí.
¿Otra vez la última parte? Gracias.
Ok. En relación a la propuesta de Eric de construir una teoría estructural de las posibilidades,
but in relation to Eric's proposal to construct a theory about the possibilities.
¿Qué lugar teórico le asignarías a la crisis en el sentido de poder, tal vez no prever, pero sí favorecer, potenciar procesos de avances no capitalistas?
What is the theoretical place for an idea about crisis and its place in thinking about alternatives to capitalism?
Okay. Both of these sets of comments, I think, are really interesting. And let me first say something about what Todd said. Also, by the way, of course, I don't want this to be... I keep saying this, but, you know, I'm a professor. What can I do? I don't want this to be just back and forth, like I've given a talk and then I'm responding to queries. But... since I've started on this one, let me say something very briefly, but then open it for more general. Todd's absolutely right, and it's something which, at least in some version, I thought I had said, but maybe I didn't say it explicitly enough. That is, that to reject the thesis of unsustainability is not to affirm the counter-thesis of permanent sustainability. It's to say, we don't know what the future holds with respect to that issue. And I think that is the correct thing to say. So that the defenders of capitalism's view that capitalism is the end of history, that this is the final stage of development of economic structures, and from now on the only question is how to perfect its functioning rather than, and remove its obstacles rather than any precariousness as a social order it might have. Well, I think there's no good argument for that position. Well, Eduardo came after the new rule was announced. The new rule is no eating from bags that make noise. Okay, just affirming our deeply held values and principles here. So I do think that's right, and that the point then is if you remove confidence, if you no longer have confidence in unsustainability, how does that affect the way you think about alternatives? And my argument was you have to give it more attention. You have to worry then more about how can we create the conditions for alternatives rather than simply how can we take advantage of the demise of the system to build alternatives. So that's the first point. Now, I think Julian is also correct that it's very hard to imagine any movement in the direction of an emancipatory alternative, whether it be ruptural, a big jump, or incremental, whatever, either way, without crisis playing a role, a significant role in that process, that crisis conditions will be the circumstances under which new institution building projects become easier rather than harder. That would be the general idea. Whether those crisis opportunities are of the character that allow a complete break with existing institutions is a separate matter. The advantage of the non-sustainability thesis is that you had reason to believe that eventually you would get that kind of crisis, a crisis of sufficient intensity that the existing institutions could actually be destroyed rather than simply modified or new institutions built alongside them because more space would be allowed or whatever. In the absence of a non-sustainability crisis, that is a crisis that really is throwing into question the reproduction of all of the whole of the basic structure, in the absence of that, while we still will expect that crisis becomes the occasion for successful struggle, we no longer have reason to believe that crises will be of the form that allows for that kind of fundamental assault on the basic underlying structure itself. Because we don't know that crises will intensify to that point. All we know is that there will be periodic opportunities. So it's more the crisis as a window of opportunity view than it is the crisis as the conditions for revolutionary transformation view. Okay, other reactions to this first set of issues around crisis and non-sustainability. Catherine.
I think when I was reading it, one of the first things that I was thinking was that not having a crisis doesn't seem like it's a bad. Not having, getting to the point where you have such an overwhelming crisis the system collapses overnight doesn't seem like it's really necessarily an impediment to social change. And a lot of the, like, just a lot of research is always about how you make opportunities rather than how they're there and the subjective values that are given to political opportunities in order to take hold of them. So one group may not see something as an opportunity where another one might. So having continued small crises without having an escalation of crises doesn't necessarily mean that you can't have social change in there.
Okay, that's a really interesting idea, and that let's sharpen that as a perhaps an even stronger alternative view. So one view, which I think both Todd and Julian were at least building the intuitions about, which I also share to some extent, is the view that fundamental social change is easier when institutions are shaken, as opposed to when they're just going along fine. But there is another view, which is that the best functioning capitalism with the most robust and stable rates of employment with the least crisis tendencies would actually be the kind of capitalism where people might be prepared to take risks for social change because they're less individually vulnerable. The problem with crisis conditions is that individuals become vulnerable, not just institutions. And so, one view is that Sweden is a better setting for new breakthroughs in democratic and participatory and egalitarian institution building. Sweden is a better place for it than a capitalist country that's not doing as well because people can embark on new projects of social change without feeling that they're risking as much. The transition costs might be lower given the stability of the system rather than the transition costs are lower because the system is unstable.
Historically, Sweden has not been, you can theorize about that, but if we look at the history of the 20th century, at some point you also say that the places where the revolution or the capitalism was challenged or was in the third world countries or Russia, and those that were doing less good. I'm not saying that proves a theory. I'm saying that in that discussion we should take into account that fact.
Catherine.
I think the example of Russia, though, and it's true we don't have a spectrum of what all the different outcomes are, but that's an example where there was a crisis, recently, which could have brought about a change that was better, but instead resulted in people who had the opportunity of taking power, of sort of re-solidifying it in a new way, which didn't allow for
the current. You mean the 1990 Russia?
Yeah. Or like in a lot of. Yeah, no, no, I realize. But as if, like, any crises now. Like, it wasn't a system that was functioning. It wasn't capitalism, but it was a system that wasn't functioning, that hit a crisis point, and where the alternative is not, can't necessarily be considered as having made improvements towards social goals, even though that's what caught, like, was one of the impetus for the crisis. And a lot of conflicts in Africa, too, have had that sort of outcome, where it just sort of gels into a new power hold from really strong crisis situations.
Todd?
But it just also just seems to me that we're more likely to see in, say, the next 50 years, I mean, obviously, who knows, right, but sort of actually much more likely to see widespread destabilization of capitalism than we are to see widespread Swedenification of capitalism, right? We're not likely to see a bunch of robust welfare states, granted that something that Sweden is, in fact, a sort of robust welfare state now.
It's called the blonde robust welfare state.
In the sense that, you know, and actually I think the second question on the agenda about environmentally induced crisis, I mean, I'm thinking more of peak oil and things like that than I am about, but also, I mean, water and other things of that nature.
So it's one thing to make the empirical claim that in the next era of capitalist development, there are not going to be the kind of conditions that pertained in Sweden. So that's no longer a possible model for how to make advances on an emancipatory agenda. And another thing to say, that it's actually not as good a context for breakthroughs. So far we've been mostly focusing just on the theoretical issue. If you could have your choice, would you rather be in a crisis-ridden you want to build a democratic and egalitarian future for all the reasons morally and practically that we've talked about. And you could snap your fingers, and what you can't do is create a capitalism that's going to collapse. So we've gotten rid of the non-sustainability thesis. But we could either be in a capitalism that's very unstable with lots of periodic crises, but not devastating crises. They're just the kind of crises that make life miserable for people, but don't destroy institutions. That's one type of context. Or snap your fingers and have a well-functioning, smoothly integrated, low unemployment, stable capitalism of the sort that Northern Europe iconically represents. Which of those two do you think is a better setting to make further advances towards an egalitarian and democratic society? Which could include revolutionary advances, as one of the things you might ask. So you might ask the question, which is the more likely one to overthrow? Or you might ask, which is the more likely setting to simply move in the right direction?
That's an underspecified question, I think.
Speak louder so that they...
The question seems to me underspecified because it really depends on what your model is of how you're going to try to bring about change and what your idea is of the sort of movement, organization, ideological offensive, whatever that you're going to do. If you are talking about, you know, sudden imposition of a radically different ideological base and a radically different way of organizing society, it's hard to imagine that a wealthy, stable capitalism that is working well for the majority of people is the best way to do that. If, on the other hand, you want to think about and assume that perhaps it's more likely that you will get socially desired results through something which involves gradual modification of your ideological and material base in a continuous way from where you are right now, then obviously you want something where the ground has been prepared, not something where everything is in crisis. Now, I mean, like Becky's example in the Soviet Union, that I keep on thinking of you as Becky Thatcher, I don't know why. Anyway, Kathy's example of the Soviet Union, right, where, well, first of all, the problem was it was a crisis of communism, not a crisis of capitalism. But also, when the crisis was there, there was no potential ideology, no potential base that was going to push things in a more emancipatory direction. So when it totally depends on what is actually there when the crisis occurs. There's a crisis in the United States right now. You're not going to have people jumping up and becoming socialists outside of this room.
We'll jump up and down. Eduardo.
Well, this might be almost actually a question based on some intuitions, I suppose. That when we're talking about crisis, where do we have to locate the crisis itself? We're actually talking about a capitalist crisis, or should it be a kind of exploitation of the crisis onto other kind of social sites? So for example, I would say, I don't know if it's a good sum, but anyways, hope it makes clear the question. For example, we have Latin America. Continuously, governments are being overthrown because of the crisis that's being produced by different forms of accumulation and so on. And it seems that the crisis is pretty much located within the political realm in terms of the state responding or not to the different demands that come from the population. But when new governments come forward, it seems that the economic structure continues to be in its place with the same principles, with the same logic. So up to what point you would say that actually the model itself, like a capitalist model, is in crisis, or that the crisis has been according to almost a different sphere where situations are trying to be resolved because they're not touching this other part of the whole picture. Actually, the capital system itself, in terms of allowing forms of accumulation and concentration of power, economic power and so on, continues to reproduce itself. So, for example, just to finish my question, if it's understood at all, like we would say that from that point of view, a welfare state that is vulnerable in terms of allowing different kinds of demands that have certain impact over the economic sphere, would that be a better or more perfect, a kind of perfect model of capitalism, or actually would a neoliberal model where actually there's all these corporations that remain untouched be a more perfect model of capitalism that actually has the potentiality to continue reproducing itself? So in terms of crisis, that particular model will never actually be experience a crisis. And while we wait for that to happen, a lot of more years can continue to pass. And so there will be necessary to come up with some other kinds of forms.
I have a clarifying question. I'm not sure I understand. Are you saying that, are you asking whether it is the case that as a result of economic crisis, rather than blaming an inherently unstable capitalism, people can or do tend to blame the state, and the state just takes the blame, and therefore what you have is a political regime change as opposed to a change in an economic regime? Is that what you're asking?
Well, no, what I'm asking two things here. First, when we're talking about that the capitalist system is in crisis, what were we referring by that? Which I think it's much easier to see maybe in a welfare state, where actually, because of crisis, you have to regulate economy and so on to continue to sort of broad accord between the population and the labor force and the market and so on. Or when we're talking about crisis, we're talking that maybe we all live in crisis in a society that's feeling full of crisis, but actually that doesn't touch the economic system itself.
The theoretical context here is one which is centering around crises that are caused by malfunctions for one reason or another in the economic structure. So these are about economic crises as then signaled by increasing bankruptcies, increasing unemployment, all the disruptions of ordinary economic life, which then both impact on the ordinary lives of people, but also the lives of elites and the power of capital. So this is meant to be accumulation crisis. That was what was at the core of the Marxian idea. Of course, those crises may then also get displaced onto other venues. They may become political crises, or they may become ideological and cultural crises. They may generate military crises. I mean, one standard way which states deal with economic disruption is to invade another country, right? And that can then provoke a crisis of a whole different sort. So there's no claim that the crisis gets resolved necessarily at the economic level. It can be displaced, and that can become the dynamic problem. On Rahul's point about the underspecification of the problem, I think your elaboration is the, of course, the implicit specification of this problem. That is, whether you feel crisis is a necessary condition for the kinds of transformations we are talking about, or whether crisis actually can impede those transformations, depends upon your view of the nature of the transformative and strategic question, which includes an account of what sorts of agency you think is possible for these kinds of changes. In those terms, the kind of classical Marxian view was more or less, this is a bit of an exaggeration, but more or less that it's an all or nothing situation, that the kind of changes that would be possible inside a society within which capitalism is the dominant form of production, those kinds of changes will be of minor and basically not very important consequence for the lives of people. But you can't really make progress towards constructing an emancipatory alternative interior to a capitalist society. And therefore, you need to plan for the possibility of rupture, of really a rapid transformative project, which was then classically termed revolution. And that was because of a belief that metamorphosis just wasn't a possibility, you know, that that kind of strategy would always unravel. And indeed, I mean, those of you and us who engage in such discussions, even today when I raise these issues and I come, you know, to somebody who's really committed to a strong traditional revolutionary perspective on these things, they have quite a lot of disdain for reformism on the grounds not that there's necessarily bad faith on the part of the supporters, although there's that as well. You know, reformism is seen as opportunism and careerism and a sellout. I mean, there's all of that. But the main objections are not so much bad faith on the part of supporters, but that it's doomed to fail, that whatever gains you make will then unravel very quickly. And so you can't make stable gains for the lives of people of the sort that you care about, except if you have a ruptural strategy. And if you have a ruptural strategy, then surely it must be the case that crisis has to be one of the conditions for rupture. It's hard to imagine how you could ever have a ruptural strategy which was enhanced by stability. And then, of course, that leads to views which then can become quite perverse, which is things have to get worse before they can get better. Well, maybe we can help make them worse so that they can get better, so that you might actually engage in strategies which have the effect of intensifying crises, which make lives worse for people, in the hope that by so doing, you would increase their mobilizability for this more ruptural transformation.
That was actually a big debate within classical Marxism. It's true that the ones who made revolutions were on one side, but there was a debate, right? Kautsky versus Bernstein. It's not that it was all on one side, but even within classical Marxism.
I mean, you just said or that Rahul's question was that it depends on the form of agency for transformation, but it also depends on where you're going. The whole question of whether you can imagine utopian alternatives emerging out of stable systems like Sweden. So if, for example, one of your stipulations is that, you know, all enterprises with more than 100 workers have to be socialized in some sense, not necessarily state-owned, but they have to be transformed in some sense that negates private property, as we understand it. It's pretty hard for me to imagine how that kind of institutional transformation in the definition of property rights would be accomplished in some place that's, you know, a stable capitalist welfare state. I mean, you can imagine things like, you know, incremental democratization of workplaces in the direction of more autonomy, but sort of if you think that things like that are fundamentally necessary, then that's harder to imagine. And that's not quite a question of agency and transformation. It's a question of the destination.
And so if you're designed for real utopian alternatives, that, and this is precisely the kind of issue that an Envisioning Real Utopia's framework for thinking about change is meant to trigger. If your vision is that there, that the changes you want are very lumpy, that there are not intermediate steps, so there's no, there's nothing that could be meaningfully called partial socialization. It's either socialized or not socialized. There's no intermediate steps. Well, if that's the nature of the design, that it has no intermediate steps, then of course it's true. It becomes much harder to imagine how you would institute it in a incremental way. That is, some kinds of alternatives have a big bang quality to them. They're all or nothing. But for example, the example you gave was, how could you imagine socializing the means of production under stable and prosperous conditions? I mean, doesn't that only, isn't that only imaginable under crisis conditions? Well, the Meidner proposals in Sweden in the 1970s were, in fact, a proposal for how you might go about socializing the means of production in a very slow and incremental way over a 40 or 50 year period. And the idea was essentially that the Swedish working class would buy Swedish capitalism. You know, I mean, that's the kind of crude way of putting it, but the idea was that corporations would be forced by law to issue new stock each year, which would be allocated to a wage earner fund. They would allocate each year, they would issue 5%, let's say, new stock. Probably it was less than that, it was probably 2%, whatever. So there'd be 2% new stocks would be issued that go into a wage earner fund that's managed by the trade union movement. The effect of that is to dilute private ownership, but very slightly. But it also provided a source of capital for Swedish capitalists, because they would issue these new stock. They would get cash for it. I mean, they weren't just giving it away. The cash that they would get would be paid for by taxes. So you had this idea that basically you'd raise taxes slightly to buy stock from capitalists that would be new stock. So the firms would actually get the capital. These new stocks would go into a wage earner's fund, which over a 40 or 50 year period of years would result in that wage earner fund controlling all of Swedish capitalism. Now,
what happened to the original stock?
Well, if you keep adding new stock, then the private stockholders gradually become very minority holders of stock in the corporation. They never are expropriated directly. It's just that you dilute their ownership. But you do so in a way that's not harmful to the corporations involved, because they continue to get new influxes of capital through. So it's a very clever device. And it imagined that you then have democratically run unions, which would control these huge wage earner stock funds, which would have effective control by the collectively organized working class on the capitalists, on capital, in which there still would be private wealth holders who would have some stake in these firms, but they wouldn't have leverage in the firms. Well, you know, I'm not saying that that was a practical strategy. It certainly failed. I mean, it was the cause of the first election in 40 years that the Social Democratic Party lost in 1976, I believe it was. The Swedish bourgeoisie mobilized massively to oppose this, and successfully. It may not have been achievable, but it nevertheless, in terms of the structural logic, was feasible. You know, there's nothing unviable about it. My only point there is to just illustrate this question. That kind of proposal is unlikely to have been even imaginable under crisis conditions. That particular proposal is one that presupposed a stable, well-functioning, state-managed capitalist economy within which you could do this kind of incremental sleight-of-hand transfer of ownership rights over an extended period of time. And it turned out to be politically not possible, which is a separate issue, I think.
You could also imagine this happening, but it not actually changing very much the way anything was done. One of the questions is, especially if you want to talk about ruptural versus gradual approaches, is
what has to accompany the gradual changes that will undermine the ability of capitalism to accommodate to them. Presumably, if there's a ruptural change, it's harder for capitalism to accommodate. But if you go slowly and gradually, you've got to be thinking also about how to undermine that ability to accommodate.
Somebody here was going to.
I just and you had mentioned that there was a political issue that's separate from the institutional issue, but I don't know that we can separate them. And when we talk about mobilization and being able to gain that support, perhaps it's a different question of whether crisis is better than stability. But I really think, at least in the developed world, if you look at the U.S. as an example, and maybe this gets back to my issue I brought up last week, but if you're raised in a system where you believe your entire life and you're told your entire life that you're in the best of all possible systems, you know, and so on, there's a social psychology there that we need to address as well. So I think in moments of crisis where people see or can, they can actually visually see where the system that they're in is perhaps not the best, and there are downfalls to this system, I think they're much more open to change. And I think that's an important part, and institutional and politically, I think we always have to think of them together and can't separate them.
That is a very good point. That is, if you see one of the main obstacles to transformation, the ideological blinders that people have, their beliefs about the desirability of the existing world. So it's not that people are unhappy, but just don't have the capacity to challenge. It's that they think they're happy. And that's the sort of situation in which a crisis might be necessary, because there's a grievance deficit. Mm-hmm. Many of the harms in my inventory, my menu of harms, I think are harms that people can experience even in a well-functioning capitalism. They're not harms that only become grievances when conditions are really bad. Mm-hmm. But it may be that it's impossible to convince people of that so long as basic material conditions are more or less intact and predictable for people.
There's definitely a cultural factor there.
Kathy?
It's funny, the whole crisis thing is interesting, because it makes me think on one level, like, for what comes after, you'd be more interested, say, for raising everyone's standard of living, so that everyone has an education, so that everyone develops a culture of participating in whatever is going to come after or the capacity to formulate it, so you don't result in another asymmetrical power distribution. So that's sort of a good reason for the sort of slow change as opposed to overnight change. And I also sort of think with crisis situations, it's hard to tell whether the reaction is going to be to close in, to close ranks and to fight more strongly, or to not. And I think sort of as the agricultural crisis has intensified, there's more debate about it every year, but 99% of the farm bill in the U.S. hasn't changed since the first one was written, because every year there's just more panic and more fear of losing. So it becomes harder to change anything and even to discuss anything. So everything that's different this year is peripheral.
Before we move further down the list, is there anyone from the far reaches of the world who would like to add some comments to this particular discussion? Then we'll move on. I was going to suggest we discuss a little bit of the environmental issue and the globalization question, the ones that were in the middle.
And then
we'll go down to the labor theory of value.
Okay.
So no comments right now from
Oh no.
Okay. Okay. Let's turn to the issue of environmental crisis and whether it might be an alternative to the classical Marxian crisis theory as a way of understanding how capitalism itself could become weakened. So the classical theory centers around the very conditions of accumulation eroding because of the declining rate of profit, so that the system becomes more vulnerable because with a very low rate of profit, then all of these irregular periodic crises have much bigger consequences because they're operating on such a low base. Whereas Marx didn't see environmental crises as a source of instability for capitalism. There's occasional little mentions of things around the environment, but I don't think he felt, and classical Marxists in general did not feel, that the environment would be something that could destroy the possibility of capitalism. But yet people do believe that's possible now. Catherine, you raised that.
Yeah, I think one of the things with environmental change that not so much is it destroying your ability to continue to exploit the land, is more that it ends up creating more instability and more conflicts, and you have a huge cost associated with those conflicts. And whether it's creating like the cause of wars, to just the cost of having to, if you poison land that people live on, then those are other people who are going to be moved to a different place and are more of a cause of uprising. I think the cost that companies put into being able to actually carry out their business in a land, in areas where they've alienated population, often through environmental reasons, is higher. And then it makes it not, like, you can't, once the cost of protecting what you're doing or the cost of defending it becomes too costly for you to continue that activity, it destabilizes the system.
Yeah. What do you think? Do you think, so there's two possible effects of environmental crisis. One is the direct effect that the conditions of nature become destroyed in ways which undermine capitalism. You know, the extreme version of that is if you destroy the planet, you destroy capitalism, but there's a version short of complete devastation. And the second is that environmental problems could be a source of sufficient social instability and resistance and conflict that the costs of containing the social conflicts would be what would be destabilizing for capitalism, not so much the direct costs of the environmental crisis itself.
I think we have to be clear about what we mean by environmental crisis, right? So, you know, peat oil is one thing that you can imagine having various sorts of effects on. I mean, obviously, that's conditioned on whether or not there are technological advances that create new sources of energy. It could mean nothing, right? But if there's a 20-year lag or something between declining oil supplies and invention of new alternatives, that could mean something. Population growth is another thing that's out there that, if there's lack of growth or negative growth in population, that could have certain kind of wage structures and things like that, ramifications. Global warming is something different, right? That, might increase social conflict or, people being displaced and things like that, but the effects of it on actual capitalist production aren't necessarily obvious.
I think sometimes if the conflicts are far away, you can ignore them. And I think there are there's increasing tension between nomadic and sedentary groups because of shortage of resources that are adding to a lot of battle, like fights, civil wars. And it's increasingly a source of tension between populations that didn't used to have tensions between them. And so when they're far away, you can ignore them. But at a certain point, you can't ignore them anymore. The oil crisis, we could wait till, you could consider a shortage of oil being a problem, or you consider the increasing cost of producing oil because of tensions around lands that have been
poison where people can't live anymore. Or increasing population, too. They all create more tension over limited resources, which makes intervening in those places a lot harder.
Yeah.
I think there's a difference between the kinds of environmental crises we're talking about. On the one hand, we have crises caused by scarcity, which naturally leads to, you know, it's about competition over resources. But I think, in general, as far as we know, capitalist development tends to ameliorate that. It tends to decrease scarcity. At least it has historically.
But if you look at California now, there's a big war around water between the north and the south.
Yes.
All the decrease of scarcity has involved spending down the accumulated energy and fossil fuels.
Well, and then the other type of crisis you talk about is, there might be three, that the increasing cost of diminishing resources, right? That it's a different type of scarcity. It's a supply scarcity as opposed to a demand scarcity. And as Todd was saying, that it could be either a hiccup for capitalism or it could be a devastating crisis, but there's no matter of principle on which we can answer the question. It's sort of an empirical question.
If the most dire predictions of environmental critics turn out to be correct, you know, so if we really go to the sharpest versions of these, then it would seem that the disruptive effects of the combination of global warming and the exhaustion of oil, those two, more than things like toxicity and the like, that those disruptive effects might be beyond the management capacity of capitalism to deal with. And the most likely response would be the calls for more state regulation and intervention. But since these are global rather than local problems, that could be the context that precipitates the formation of stronger and more autonomous and interventionist global type state machineries. That would seem to me the most likely scenario would be stronger international institutions, which may be under the control of particular blocks of states. Whether or not that would also lead to a destabilization of capitalism, whether capitalism would become a threatened structure through which property rights and investment decisions get made, it seems much less clear, as opposed to states intervening in order to stabilize those relations and then solve the collective action problems, the coordination problems that markets can't solve with respect to things like global warming. You know, so I can imagine a carbon tax proposal that's really quite severe, so that it really creates disincentives for carbon emissions, which then becomes part of the parameters under which ordinary capitalist decisions would be made if those carbon taxes could be effectively imposed. But that requires quite a surveillance and state apparatus to have to have really effective carbon trading and carbon taxes and the like. But I don't see an inherent reason why that course of action wouldn't be the most likely response to environmental crises.
Well, I just wonder the level of, like, right now Michigan and Wisconsin, for example, have tried to sign an agreement with Ontario about the water management of the water basin we're in, and the federal government has refused to sign it because it would basically say we cannot take water outside of that basin for the rest of the U.S. So there's one of the states right next to us really needs water. And so does not want the federal government to sign it, because then they would not be able to export water from this water basin. Mm-hmm. And I just find it's within the same country, essentially, that the conflict is existing. The water is really essential to both agriculture and industry. And there's no alternatives that have even managed to be able to be discussed. It's yes or no, and it's brought sort of this power play out
that's crucial to industry. And there's no solution. So does it just hit the wall before something can happen? And that's sort of the, and I think those like small types of conflicts are happening in more and more places, and we're not developing those economic or those political tools to deal with problems which will have huge economic impacts.
But that sort of sounds like capitalism under conflict is, or conflict under capitalism as usual to me. But the things I'm thinking about are, well, first of all, I mean, I think that the population, I keep harping on this, but like, I mean, this is not a prediction. This is a reality in Japan and Europe where changing age structures of populations are making welfare states vulnerable, if not impossible, and that there are large sort of political ramifications for that. But I also think that, again, the whole, you know, just imagine the scenario in which there's a 20-year lag between, you know, declining oil supplies and some new technology, some new source of energy, where, I mean, that, you know, if that leads to, you know, a 20-year depression or something like that, I mean, we're looking at the kinds of scenarios that are transitions through crisis, not transitions through Sweden. And I just, you know...
Yeah. Well, that thing that I think we are discussing, the question of socialism or barbarism, I mean, because barbarism and under these circumstances would be an environmental crisis. I mean, maybe some other would think global wars or something like that, but there could be a possibility if we don't change the system that we go to like something like that. We can call it some other way, like, but it's this idea.
Okay, just a couple of comments, and then let's move on to, with respect to this. The scenarios that have been laid out are not so much socialism or barbarism, but socialism or increasingly nasty capitalism, right? As opposed to barbarism being an alternative to capitalism. So barbarism and socialism are two futures of capitalism, to capitalism. But what's being described here is a less benign and less progressive or egalitarian form of capitalism. So with respect to environmentalism, environmental crises, what one would predict under capitalist conditions is that the costs of environmental destruction get very unequally borne by people. So environmental injustices become an increasingly salient dimension of the injustices of capitalism. And one of the attractions then of socialism with respect to that problem is that it has a more egalitarian response to the sacrifices needed to deal with environmental problems. But that's also, of course, one of the objections to socialism. That is, there will be elites and prosperous segments of capital societies that will prefer environmental injustice to the egalitarian alternative, just as they prefer inegalitarian education systems and inegalitarian health systems. We have a health crisis for the poor. We have an educational crisis for the poor. None of those seem to deeply destabilize capitalism by themselves. So that's the reason why I'm a little skeptical that the environmental injustices and the conflicts that it generates would by themselves be sufficient to provide a basis for a real challenge to capitalism, unless along with it there was something that eroded the sort of profitability and accumulation process itself, which Todd was suggesting might be the case because of the gap between when oil prices go through the roof, for example, and new technologies emerge to, you know, replace them, and it's possible that the time lags could be such that you'd have a hugely disruptive period.
Well, I think it becomes a little bit more reasonable to think this if you really specify the scope of the problem, which I don't think we have. I mean, it's not that there are that many even conceivable alternatives, especially with regard to the particular question of fossil fuels running out. There's only two even imaginable
alternative sources of energy in the next 50 years that could rival fossil fuels here, and those are nuclear fission and solar energy. And solar is a very big if. It's not at all clear that it's possible. So it's not just capitalism, but industrialism in general. The entire system of production is fundamentally dependent on fossil fuels, and they're running out. So, I mean, we don't know the exact time scale, but at a time when that becomes an issue, then it's. I mean, the question is: can we imagine capitalism surviving decoupled from the entire mode of production? I mean, the physical mode of production that we have, is that what we're talking about?
But what you raise is also the issue that in order for socialism of one sort or another to be an attractive alternative, there has to be some credible claim that it will be able to cope with this better way.
Yeah.
What is clear is that socialism would cope with it in a more just way. That is, the sacrifices and disruptions that will accompany whatever transition to new technologies would be needed under this scenario that we're describing, and whether it be the global warming scenario or the fossil fuel scenario, one would imagine that under a democratic socialist context, the sacrifices and deprivations which accompany that transition would be more equally shared. The burdens would be less unequally distributed. But it's not clear that the actual solution to the problem would be more effective, because that depends upon all sorts of contingent facts about the nature of the technical problems to be overcome and the sorts of lines of development that are likely to occur under capitalist or non-capitalist conditions. We like to think of socialism as being both more just and more efficient with respect to innovation, but that's an issue about which we don't have convincing arguments to skeptics, I think. Let's move on down. Let's see where we are. It's 25 to 6. We spent quite a bit of time on these crisis issues. The two other ones before the labor theory of value question at the bottom of this first block has to centered around globalization and financial crisis as another possible source of crisis tendencies in capitalism. The idea that the arena within which capital accumulation takes place has outstretched the capacities of its regulation without there being prospects of global regulation replacing it. And if it is the case that the solution to the crisis tendencies and their highly disruptive potential in the previous historical period came from the fact that national territories were regulated by strong states, which were capable of regulating capital in the interests of capitalism, to be sure, but in ways that muted crisis tendencies, then one might expect that the era to follow will, if not becoming ever more intense, would have more intense crises than the era we've left, because the regulatory capacity to blunt those crises will be reduced. So that's the kind of globalization and financial crisis sort of scenario. Financial crisis being the form in which such global crises are likely to take. Guillaume and Charity both raised issues in that cluster, I think. If you want to,
do you want to
comment on it?
I think both of those two points kind of point to my principal point between the developing world and the ability of states. And I think, you had said, as a critique of Marx, that he undermined the state's ability to... Underestimated the state's ability. But especially if we look at the developing world, we see states that are very vulnerable to international capital and also other states or other alliances of states. So I think his thesis does hold in the sense of there's no ability or there's no mechanism of controlling those crises or resolving those crises. And I think we see that more specifically in the developing world, perhaps, than in the highly developed societies. So I think that was a point I was bringing into that with the developing countries. And maybe Julia had something more.
Yeah, it looks like Jan wants to, but I just want to say it real quick. Yeah, and I feel like I was trying to think of, in terms of this question of would you rather be Sweden or a Central American country or whatever the opposite example you would give. And I wonder if there's a broader question of do you want to be Sweden in the year 2008 and in the global context of the capitalist system as it stands today? And is that then a different question about how... what Sweden's place is, not just relative to the capitalism as it exists inside Sweden, but relative to the rest of the world and what the options are for the state to propose anything. And so, and then what are, how does that change the question of looking at the possibilities of Sweden and looking at the possibilities of other countries that don't look as close to the idea of what we're looking for? Guillaume?
Okay. I'll take a slightly different position than you, Charity. It seems to me that the smaller states or the states that are going under development are somewhat marginalized by the major players in the financial crisis. And what is happening is that the major players are actually just trying to solidify or consolidate their current position. And in the example I brought up, like demonetization of gold and silver was a strategic, in fact, probably action to probably marginalize smaller states. And in fact, the way it's kind of being played out in global politics is that it's the birth bang of capitalism, and it does not matter all that much to the great financial players. And what was my biggest concern about this is that if you have kind of a fate-based system, then you're kind of dealing only with a few currencies in the world. And the U.S. is one of them, and you guys probably read my note, but it's other countries that are, like Japan and China, are absorbing the trade deficit. So in fact, it's Marx was talking when... the dollar was pegged to the gold standard, which is often seen as a cause to the financial crisis. Whereas now it seems that it's a much smoother softer issue where like the crisis might not be as hard but might be prolonged. And I think maybe the proper terminology would be like the talk of a long depression. Mm-hmm. For an area that is highly developed, but some other countries that are going under development might have an exponential growth.
When you say demonetization, just clarify question, demonetization of gold, you're talking about Nixon taking the dollar off the gold standard and all that in the 70s?
Right? Yeah, and the silver dollar in the previous cycle. At the end of the English cycle, like they dealt with gold and silver, and then the Chinese had so much silver that England said, oh, we're not going to deal with silver anymore.
But are you talking about states in particular as institutions? Because I think I was very much pointing to the idea of the state and how we visualize the state as things change. And the states have become weaker as we see international capital growing, and international capital has the autonomy to move where they want, but that leaves states internally less able to deal with those crises.
But not all states. A few states have become weaker. The Chinese state at this point is pretty much setting the rules almost to where their currency is going to be pegged to the American mm-hmm. dollar.
But even in alliances, we see that particular states have to go along with other states because of the power structures within those. So if our focus is individualist states thinking about their ability, I think my point remains that individual states become weaker. And you may have to look at these global alliances, but there's still these power structures within it. So the crisis of capital becomes a question of global capital rather than national capital.
Yes, but why would this set of smaller states be able to rival the current, economic order or financial order
that is resolving those crises? Well, if we have to look at downward or pressure from below, right? If you have states that aren't resolving those crises internally, perhaps you have more mobilization for change. So that was my way of thinking of addressing the reading. Thinking of, well, if states can resolve these issues, you know, capitalism is going to continue as normal. It's going to be stable. But within a state itself, if you have more pressure from below, that aren't seeing those resolutions, because international capital is going to just resolve what it needs to resolve, and there's going to be lots of other areas untouched. I don't know. I think.
In terms of the sort of logical structure of the argument that I've set up, which is evaluating the non-sustainability of capitalism thesis in terms of the firmness of our expectations about the likely course of crisis in the future, one way of integrating your comments into this would be to say the classical Marxian view was that the motor force that drives crisis gets more and more intense. Sort of the economic contradictions get more and more intense. I then countered by saying, but that underestimates the capacity of states to counteract those contradictions. Your argument is, but the capacity of states to do so declines over time. So if we had a reason to predict that over the next epoch of capitalism, the next extended period, there would be a continual erosion of states' capacity to counter whatever crisis tendencies there are. And we may, financially generated crises could be one, but there could be all sorts of other crisis tendencies, including the environmental ones that we're talking about. If the whole capacities of states to neutralize those goes down, then that's another reason to believe and intend that there will be a secular intensification of crises. Not because the economic engine of crisis accelerates, but because the neutralizing mechanisms become weaker.
Eric, when you're talking about the intensification of the internal contradictions of capitalism, what are you...
Rising organic composition of capital.
You're talking about Marx's falling rate of profit theory?
Yeah. I was just reinvoking that.
Yeah.
The element in Marx that gave us some directionality to the intensity of crisis rather than just cycles.
I think there's an issue with the levels. There's a levels problem with what we're talking about. I think when Marx's theory of economic crisis was today what we would call a business cycle, it's just that in the 19th century, the business cycle was much more severe. If the magnitude of the trough and the peak were a much greater magnitude than they were today. And I think that the state's ability to regulate crisis, in Marx's sense, is their ability to regulate this business cycle. I think Marx's theory of falling rate of profit, which operates on another, on a higher level of abstraction and
a longer time scale,
and along a much larger time scale, I think would be completely out of the hands of the state to ameliorate. I mean, it would. Marx considers it something completely inexorable. So I think Marx might acknowledge that there's been increasing potential for the state to regulate the business cycle, and that may now be diminishing because of globalization. But I think he might say that that is not necessarily related to the secular decline, but to the waves that we take along
right,
the way.
Right, but the two are connected in that the reason why the troughs get deeper and the peaks get shallower is because of that secular decline.
Yes, but if we're able to make the peaks less shallow and the troughs, the peaks less high and the troughs less shallow, and we're still on a secular decline, then that means...
So my point would be, I don't believe that there's a long-term secular decline. So that part of the story I've dropped.
Yeah.
So that we have no particular directionality to the rate of profit in the long run. It can go up and go down and can stay the same.
Yeah.
Therefore, the cycles around that rate of profit will be sometimes big, sometimes small, but the state was able to ameliorate them.
Yeah.
If that goes down, then we now have a longer-term prediction that crises will intensify over time, not because the base rate of profit is declining, but because the neutralizing mechanisms are declining.
Yeah, and in that case, you're necessarily in the territory that Todd specified earlier, where crises don't become self-destructive things, but opportunities for us as, you know,
right.
positive agents to, you know, transform society. Not that it will happen independently.
They're the windows of opportunity for transformation.
If we're talking about crises that are driven purely by economic matters, I think it's important to point out that I think even though it's sort of in theory, Marxists understand, maybe even a few classical economists understand the difference between the economy and economic matters and the actual, you know, physical world that it relates to, there's a real tendency to confuse and mix the two up. It is entirely possible to have major economic crises that change absolutely nothing. You know, in 1999 and 2000, the NASDAQ, which reflects the most dynamic sector of corporate America, the tech stocks, it lost about two-thirds of its value. It's never fully recovered. It made no difference to anybody. This was an economic crisis that created no political ramifications whatsoever. Similarly, you have cases where the rate of profit in a lot of corporations is falling because their capital is meaninglessly overvalued through speculative markets, so that their so-called market capitalization is a completely unrealizable, meaningless number. And if it happens to fall by a factor of four through a correction, it makes little difference. And now suddenly their profit rate is four times higher.
One of Marx's central ideas is that capitalist crisis is not, in terms when we're talking about the business cycle and not about a falling rate of profit, is the way that the system maintains its health. You know, capitalism grows and remains vital by going through crisis in much the same way that the body goes through a fever to get healthy. You know, it's part of the mechanism of re-equilibration.
Yeah, but now we can actually have crises that really don't seem to affect anybody. They don't even affect employment very much, let alone anything else.
Well, they do. So.
Yeah, you exaggerated slightly there.
The fact that unemployment
the unemployment rate has remained roughly the same through all of that, okay?
I just happen to know people that lost their jobs.
Well, yeah. That's different from effect.
Yeah, I know. I just
let's finish off this first block and then take our break. The last item on it, which we've been brushing up against, which seems dear to the heart of a couple of people, has to do with the relationship of the labor theory of value to all of this stuff that we're talking about.
What was I?
Rodrigo, which is Rodrigo?
Here I am.
Hi, Rodrigo. And your comrade on this theme is Ido.
Hi.
Start.
Okay.
Okay. My point was very clear, I suppose. And the thing is that the answer you gave to my points, I understood that you reject the labor theory of value. That's why we didn't found the notion of surplus value in chapter 2. That was something I noticed when I read chapter 3. I just want to comment that one of the main points about the non-sustainability of capitalist thesis is about the crisis that your critic about the law of fallacy tendencies of the right profiles. And that law bases on the labor theory of value. Your critique to that law is based, I couldn't understand if it's based on an empirical fact or a theoretical fact. But I suppose that it's theoretical and have to, it's related to the labor theory of value. But how can you reject that theory without reject the exploitation issue? Because exploitation is based basis in that theory also. In chapter two, is not explained it an alternative way to explain the notion of exploitation, or I didn't understand that.
Okay. Ido, do you want to add something, or should I respond to the exploitation point?
Very hard to explain.
Yeah.
No, I understood your.
I think this is such a big conversation to have that I'm not sure it's worthwhile having, given the fact that there's so many other fruitful things to discuss.
Okay. Well, let me respond to this particular point, then.
I'm happy to let the point go on.
Okay. I don't think the concept of exploitation derives from the labor theory of value. I think the labor theory of value is one way of formalizing the problem of exploitation. So it has its uses, but I don't think that, in fact, the concept of exploitation or its sociological importance as a way of understanding the nature of class relations depends upon the adequacy of labor values as the measure of the value of commodities and the determinant of the relative prices of commodities. That is, these are separable problems. Now, the place where I attempt to elaborate a concept of exploitation independently of the labor theory of value is not in this book. It's in Class Counts in the first chapter. There is a discussion of three conditions that have to be met in order to describe a social relationship as exploitative. And those three conditions can be described without reference to the labor theory of value. They have to do with the nature of the interdependencies of people within systems of production and appropriation. You can talk about the appropriation of the fruits of labor, the products of labor, and the expenditure of effort in the production of those products, and the social relations that bind together people within that process. You can do so in a way that establishes a concept that I think is, at least sociologically, the meaning of exploitation, without having to add the additional argument that the appropriate and best way of measuring the products and the value of labor power is by the abstract, socially necessary labor time it takes to produce them. That's a perfectly good heuristic, but it's not part of the conceptualization of the concept of exploitation itself. I mean, that's not providing you with the details of my defense, but that's why at least I don't think you need the labor theory of value for that particular purpose. If it were the case that the concept of exploitation disappears, you cannot have it without also believing in the labor theory of value, if that were true, then I would reluctantly have to say, well, then we need a concept of class without a concept of exploitation, because it wouldn't follow from that definitional necessity that the labor theory of value is satisfactory. That would just be another sad fact that would follow from the demise of the labor theory of value. It would also undermine our concept of exploitation. But I don't think that, in fact, is the case. I don't think you need a labor value view of value in order to have a relational view of exploitation under conditions of private ownership and dominated labor within production. I think you just need domination in production, the extraction of labor effort, and the interdependency of capital and labor in order to get exploitation.
Read chapter one of Class Counts. Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's. I hate to have as a kind of stock response, read my chapter, but that's, if you read that chapter and have some further thoughts on this question that you'd like to discuss with me, I'd be happy to answer any emails or have any further interactions on this from that chapter. Okay, it's 6 o'clock. Let's take a break. I need to stop just a few minutes before 7 because I have to be somewhere at 7:30. And given the amount that it's snowing, I probably have to walk rather than ride my bike. Because although I do ride my bike all winter, just to impress you in Argentina, riding my bike during a heavy snowstorm at night is not actually my favorite thing to do. So I probably have to walk to my appointment at 7:30. Okay, let's take a break. Let's reconvene in 8 minutes. How's that? At 7 minutes after six.
The gold, so you can't have a question.
I know, I think. Well, this is a good question. I don't know what I can do, but I think I have to.